Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Fred, you and one of our former producers, Will Duffy, urged me to read a book, The Biotic Message, by Walter Remine. And I have just recently read it, and I have to say this is a major contribution. Now, it's published 20 years ago. But it is a major contribution to the explanation of evolution theory and to reveal the illusions that are involved when it is claimed that they have it all figured out, and in reality, they don't.
Yeah, it was my favorite book when it came out. You know, engineers think alike, maybe. I could really relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of leading creationists still quote from this book.
Some of the best and most recent creation evolution literature from some of the world-renowned scientists.
Yeah, I think, for example, Dr. John Sanford.
From Cornell University, co-inventor of the gene gun, author of Genetic Entropy. He's
yes.
a good example.
Yep.
What an honor that Real Science Friday has on the line Walter Remine, electrical engineer. Walter Remine, welcome to Real Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Walter, I have been doing shows on evolution and creation for 20 years. We air on Colorado's most powerful radio station, AM 670 KLTT. Reading your book taught me so much about Darwinism, about natural selection, and what is actually claimed by the world's leading evolutionists. So thank you for that education.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. So we're hoping Fred Williams and I have a bit of an outline of what we'd like to cover. We're hoping to start with just the general topic of illusions within evolution.
Yes.
There is this argument that body parts, like organs, have evolved. There's an argument that groups evolve, like reptiles into birds. And you address that well into your book, starting on page 278. Can you talk about that idea to begin with?
Sure. The Darwinians, the classical Darwinians, needed to create the illusion that they had identified the ancestors. They needed to identify the ancestors.
Hmm.
They believed they would be able to do that. They set out in the years after Darwin to identify the ancestors, believing they would succeed, and they spent over 100 years fumbling around in that research.
Mm.
And eventually, the classical Darwinisms really started going down in the 1970s, because they had failed. So the classical Darwinians created a great variety of illusion-making techniques, ways of creating an illusion in science. And we can dismantle these illusions in the same way that you could dismantle a magic trick and describe how the magic trick works.
Mm. You actually have a background. You're not only an electrical engineer, you're also a magician.
That's right, yes. And that helped me quite a bit in doing my research, in the ability to tease apart the various illusions that evolutionists were using.
Mm.
So I identify those illusions, and there's quite a variety of them. It's amazing the number of techniques that they use. Now, one of those techniques is technically known as paraphyletic groups. I know that's a complicated name, but
yeah.
The concept is pretty simple. It's a group of organisms that is identified by what they lack, by what they don't have. They don't possess something.
Mm.
An example is the invertebrates. They lack a vertebra.
Right.
So your octopus and clams and jellyfish, those are invertebrates. Notice how diverse they are.
Mm.
Paraphyletic groups tend to be quite large and diverse. Octopus, clams, and jellyfish are quite diverse, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that really unifies them is that they lack a vertebra. Okay? Now, evolutionists started creating these paraphyletic groups and giving them names. They gave them names, and those names became recognized in our culture. And those became used as ancestors. So whenever evolutionists needed to create an ancestor out of thin air, they would give you a paraphyletic group. For example, here's a simple example.
Mm-hmm.
Who are the ancestors of the vertebrates? Well, it's the invertebrates.
The invertebrates.
Right?
Right.
Okay, there you have an ancestor. You've created one out of thin air.
Walter, in your book, you point out this problem, but it's not just you saying it. You quote some of the world's leading evolutionists saying the same thing. So you state it very clearly. You say that these groups cannot be ancestors because they're not reproductive entities.
Right.
And then you quote authorities in evolution who are saying the exact same thing and saying that it's a big problem.
Yeah. I love it because your book's loaded with supporting references like Niles Eldridge. He's a leading evolutionist. And he gave the example. He said the literature of macroevolution is fraught with references to the derivation of one higher taxon from another, as when, for example, mammals and birds are conventionally said to be separately derived from reptiles.
So here's one of the world's leading evolutionists saying our literature is fraught with this problem. It's not valid that we say, well, look, we prove that mammals evolved from reptiles. You also quote Peter Forey, who's been with the National History Museum in London. He's written for Nature. And he says, evolutionary theory does not allow for supraspecific ancestors. A genus does not evolve from a genus, a family from a family, and so on. Actually, it's an organism that reproduces, and we could say that a species reproduces, but you just are not saying anything that has been proven when you say this group evolved into that group.
That's correct. It's part of my method, if you will, that I establish everything I'm talking about by quoting evolutionists. I quote only my opponents, and I do it a lot to establish what I'm talking about.
You do, and the evolutionists criticize you for what's called quote mining. And quote mining, like any other mining, is most profitable when the vein is deep and rich and wide.
Yeah.
And Walter, when they say you're taking these quotes out of context, that's so disingenuous.
It really
because
is.
They never show how you're taking it out of context.
Yeah.
They think that because Niles Eldridge was still an evolutionist after he wrote this, that therefore he was saying nothing.
Yes.
That's how they behave. And it's badly behaved.
Yes. I don't think they've shown any examples of me quoting out of context.
No.
I make the point that I'm quoting evolutionists, and they believe in evolution. They believe it wholeheartedly, and yet they are saying things that agree with me.
You quote Eldridge and Crockcraft, who say that logically only species can serve as evolutionary units. Nonetheless, the literature is replete with phylogenetic trees depicting ancestor-descendant relationships among genera and taxa of even higher rank. I've been debating a well-known evolutionist, Aaron Ra, whose YouTube videos have now millions of views, and he does this constantly, and he thinks by saying that reptiles evolved into birds, he thinks that that's proved the case.
Right. Reptiles are another paraphyletic group. I'll give you an example about reptiles.
Hmm.
Let's say we ask, who were the ancestors of the rabbits?
Hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Simple enough question.
Yeah. Walter, I've been looking for a rabbit in a Cambrian strata. One of these days I might find
right.
one.
Right. Swimming around in the seas. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
The Cambrian oceans.
Yes, good
around
point.
A rabbit. Yeah. So we ask, who's the ancestor of the rabbits? And suppose someone says, well, the ancestor of the rabbits was a mammal. And we'd say, well, wait a minute, the great-grandmother of the rabbit was a mammal, making your statement true, but rabbits are mammals. So it's a true statement, but it's trivial. Can't you tell me something interesting about the ancestor of the rabbits, something non-trivial? And so the evolutionist scratches his head and says, okay, the ancestor of the rabbits was an unmammal. An unmammal. Okay, that's what it wasn't.
Right.
Can you tell me something else about the ancestor? Well, okay, the ancestor of the rabbits was a non-bird and an unmammal. Yeah, that's right. Okay. No, you've told me what it isn't. Tell me what the ancestor is.
Mm.
Well, it was an amniote. It had an amniotic egg. Okay, so the ancestor had an amniotic egg. It was a non-mammal and an unbird. You mean it was a reptile? Yeah, that's what I mean, says the evolutionist.
Right.
That's the definition of a reptile. It's an amniote that was not a mammal and not a bird. And so evolutionists have, by that process, identified a huge, diverse group of organisms that includes turtles and snakes and lizards and dinosaurs, this huge, diverse group of organisms as an ancestor and use them as an ancestor. The classical Darwinians went along and created an enormous number of paraphyletic groups. As I say, that they started going down the tubes in the mid-1970s. What rose up to take their place was a group of evolutionists. I'll talk about them as being the cladists and the punctuationists.
Yeah, cladograms and punctuated equilibrium. Could we stick with this first a little bit further,
okay,
Walter? In the debate with Aaron Ra, he fancies himself as an expert on Darwin's tree of life.
Okay.
So I asked him, and then there was an awkward silence after this question. I said, well, Aaron, where did the dinosaurs evolve from? And it was silence. And and he finally said under his breath, archaeosaurs. But archaeosaurs are dinosaurs. It's a group that includes dinosaurs.
Right.
So dinosaurs evolved from dinosaurs. That's an illusion.
Yes.
And then he said, well, you can't. He said, go ahead, name a group that was a created kind. And so it's really a diversion from his inability to tell us where dinosaurs evolved from. He challenges me, so I said, okay, fine, turtles. I said, turtles were a created kind. And Aaron Ra, where did turtles evolve from?
Yeah.
And he can't tell us. They don't have a lineage of where turtles came from.
Right.
Yeah, you were exposing the illusion. And what happened soon thereafter, you were taking him out of context.
That's right. So how about now the evolving body parts scenario? Because this is really fun. Because lo and behold, then, it's claimed that body parts evolve.
Yeah, we see this all the time, right? In the textbooks, jaws evolving into jaws, teeth into teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, in the Denver Museum of Natural History, with the curator Kirk Johnson, they have an exhibit at kids' eye level saying that scales, fish scales, evolved into human teeth. Scales evolved into teeth. So there's an example of body parts evolving into body parts. And it's at kids' level, and it's such a shame. And they don't put that it's a theory or it's proposed. I challenged him on this, the curator. They put it as though it's established fact, and it's an illusion.
Yeah. That's another technique they used to create the illusion of lineage. There's a lineage of ancestor, descendant, so forth. They would select body parts from rather diverse organisms that they knew were not ancestor-descendant relationships. But they would select body parts, arrange them in a row, and present them in a textbook as though they were a lineage. Another technique they commonly used to create the illusion of lineage. Oh, here's a group of body parts from different organisms. If you had the whole organism in front of you, you'd go, no, wait a minute, those aren't ancestor descendants. They're way too different. But they would select body parts for presentation, ignore other body parts to create an illusion.
Yeah, and there's this example of Kitcher-Gish debate where he used two hypothetical.
Yes.
He made up two of them.
Yes.
And, you know, does the audience know that?
The audience didn't know that. I was so thrilled, Walter Remine, that you point that out in your book, that Dwayne Gish, a hero of the creation movement, collaborator with Dr. Henry Morris, that he's debating this well-known atheist, and it's so hard in the middle of the debate to point out, well, wait a minute, this chart you're showing, not only are you having body parts evolving into other body parts, But you're making them up.
Hypothetical ancestors. Mm. Very commonly done. Very common.
It's interesting that the article the guy's referring to specifically denied that the diagram he was showing depicted this lineage.
Right. Yeah. Right. And in other words, they said, well, here are these body parts, but we know they didn't evolve into one another. The article says that it has make-believe body parts. And then you also point out, as you've just said on the show, you point out in your book that they're very selective about the body parts that they'll say evolve one into the other, whereas they ignore others. Yes. Because then you would get contradictory evolutionary trees and the grandfather doesn't evolve from the grandson. And so this is what I wrote in round five of my debate with Aaron Ra this month. And Walter, it was inspired directly by you.
Great.
I wrote this, that when building a claimed evolutionary tree, evolutionists compare arbitrarily selected features of our anatomy. If we look at fingerprints, then perhaps we're close to koalas. And if we look at the human eye, then we're close to the octopus. 70% of the genes in the lowly Great Barrier Reef sponge are just like our human genes. And it goes on and on, the genetic evidence coming out that everything is in a very complex relationship to everything. And we believe it's because there's one creator, one designer who implemented all the organisms out of a basic genetic blueprint.
Yes. Let me add something about the illusions. There are a lot of illusions that the Darwinians created about ancestors. And along in the mid-1970s, there rose up opponents, other evolutionists who disagreed with the classical Darwinians and overthrew them. And they created a new tradition of selling evolution to the public. What they did is basically say, we don't need to identify ancestors. We can't. We can't identify the ancestors. They weren't quite that direct about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the modern tradition now, after the punctuated equilibrium theory is out there and the cladists are out there, the modern tradition among evolutionists is to avoid identifying ancestors.
Specific ancestors.
Yeah. Avoid identifying lineages, avoid identifying ancestors. In fact, what they've done is one of their tricks is they've redefined the word ancestor and lineage so that they can still use those words without ever identifying ancestors or lineages.
Wow.
So, quite a hoot to see. But the reason evolutionists have done that is they found through the centuries that when they try and identify an ancestor, they inevitably get into an argument with other evolutionists. Other evolutionists contradict them and say, no, that's not the ancestor. It's a different one.
Because the fossil record shows them out of order constantly. They've done that for decades, so it's getting tiring.
Yeah.
I think we should let the audience know what punctuated equilibrium is. I think that's funny that they came up with that idea.
The idea, in fact, the big proponents of this, Stephen Jay Gould was mm-hmm. one of them. He worked at New York City's Natural History Museum that I visited frequently growing up in northern New Jersey. We just loved to go there. And I'd get their literature. So I knew about him from back when I was a kid. I've read one of his books ever since Darwin. And so they thought this. It wasn't the hopeful monster theory. It was different. They thought that a small population of a species would get isolated. And in an evolutionary brief period of time, which was maybe tens of thousands of years or half a million years, would have a dramatic leap forward in adaptation. So punctuated equilibrium, for the most part, the fossil record is stasis through the millennia, no, through the millions of years, through the epochs. It's stationary, but then any change happens rapidly, and so it's not a surprise that we don't have the fossil record of the evolution of life.
And what cracks me up, and I'm pretty sure, Walter, this is pointed out in your book, this is where I learned this, Stephen Jay Gould used as a falsification of punctuated equilibrium, finding gradual evolution. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so there's a quote from Stephen Jay Gould that you can falsify my theory if you can show gradual evolution in the fossil record.
Right.
Oh, great. That's a great test.
So then, Walter, you pointed out that they do this to creationists all the time. They say, okay, you could prove this is false if you can prove evolution.
Yeah.
And that is the technique that they use repeatedly. I love it in your book when you point that out. Your book is The Biotic Message, Evolution versus Message Theory.
And every creationist should have this in their library.
Yeah, it is quite a book.
I claim that punctuated equilibria theory, in all its details, can be derived from three observations of the fossil record. And they are basically creationist observations. They favor creationists. And here they are. Clear-cut ancestors and lineages are systematically absent over large scales. They're absent. Ancestors and lineages are not there. What you have is diversity, great gobs of diversity, bushy, bushy diversity without clear-cut ancestors. The second observation is that there are large gaps, large morphological gaps between life forms, systematic everywhere. It's not piecemeal. The general rule of the fossil record and the record of life is there are large morphological gaps between life forms that also look like creation.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one is that these observations cannot be brushed aside by claiming the fossil record is incomplete. That's what the Darwinians tried to do. They tried to claim the fossil record was incomplete, and the punctuationists come along and say, no, that explanation doesn't work. You have to take the fossil record more literally. It's really, really telling us something.
And one reason we know that the fossil record is largely complete is because while millions of fossils have been cataloged, when we go out and we dig up, let's say in one season, some paleontologists go out and they dig up 37 new fossils somewhere in the world, they can fit them into the already existing pattern that we have.
Yes.
And so because we've been doing that for a century now, that is powerful evidence that the fossil record is largely complete.
Yes, and the punctuationists saw that, and they tried to explain it. You can take the three observations I just mentioned and lock yourself in a room. If you're an evolutionist and you're going, I have to explain these patterns that look like creation, I have to explain them in terms of evolution. You'd come out of that room with punk-ack theory in all its details.
Wow. When yeah. you said there are large morphological gaps, could we come up with a couple examples of what that would mean, morphological gaps?
Okay, first, a great quote is Stephen Jay Gould said, the large morphological gaps are the trade secret of paleontology. That they knew about it, that these evolutionists and paleontologists knew about it, but basically kept it secret for many, many decades.
Well, it's sort of like today with soft tissue and dinosaur fossils, blood vessels, blood cells. I mean, Harvard just sequenced proteins from a hadrosaur, a duck-billed dinosaur. The vast majority of the public, Fred, what is your perception? What percentage of the public does not know that this has been going on for 5 years with hundreds of scientists?
Oh, probably 80, 90%.
90%, and I think even higher. I don't know, but 95, 98%. I've been asking people for months, have you heard that they found soft tissue? And they all say, wow, I never heard that.
Yeah, it's astonishing to them.
Yeah. So the paleontologists for a long time knew that there was a serious problem showing ancestors in the fossil record.
Yeah.
And the rest of the, let's say the biologists, they didn't really know that until Gould had enough stature to come along and say, look, let's stop lying to ourselves.
Like the invertebrates, there's a huge healthy fossil record and tons of complete specimens. And there's no sign of evolution. And it's a very wealthy part of the fossil record. And yet the college textbooks, the high school textbooks, they don't give you examples of invertebrate evolution, hardly ever. They give you these piecemeal body parts evolving into body parts and these other illusions that Walter covers in his book.
What I learned about from you, Walter, is this term naive natural selection and how it is so insignificant to the entire evolutionary theory of what the public thinks, that, well, things just adapt and they just get better and better over time. That is the tiniest part of Darwinian theory as it exists today.
The modern evolutionists really abandoned classical Darwinism in two respects. They saw that the ancestors and lineages aren't there, can't be identified at least, and there are large morphological gaps between life forms. That looks really a lot like creation at this point, okay? So they abandoned classical Darwinism and moved to a theory of evolution that does not require them to identify ancestors. And you will see modern evolutionists avoiding the identification of ancestors. Again, the reason is the moment they try to identify an ancestor, they get into an argument with other evolutionists.
Is this kind of like Tiktaalik, you know, the tetrapod that supposedly evolved out of the water?
Into four legs,
and then they found footprints of an older animal, and it totally threw it out of whack.
From like 10 million years earlier, and so after saying Tiktaalik was the ancestor to the tetrapods, then lo and behold, in the strata, millions of years by their dating earlier, here's a four-foot creature walking around, leaving footprints in a trail.
And it was a darling of evolutionists, you know, the last 5 years. Now they can't use that one anymore. There's always these ancestors getting overthrown by other evolutionists, to
yes.
your point.
So the classical evolutionists would identify specific ancestors and give them names and say, look, there's the ancestor. Evolutionists strongly don't do that anymore. The modern evolutionists avoid identifying the ancestors. They talk in terms of sibling species and hypothetical common ancestors, or two organisms that have a common ancestor, like humans and chimps supposedly have a common ancestor,
right?
But they don't identify the ancestors, and that's a huge point about modern evolution.
As a general rule, that's where it's headed. Walter Remind, we're out of time. Would you be able to join us? Because we'd like to go on to your brilliant points about naive natural selection, the fitness terrain, uphill evolution, all that.
The origin of sex, all those difficult questions.
Could we do another show with you?
I'd love to.
Okay, well, Lord willing, we'll be back next week then. Fred Williams, thanks so much for being in studio.
Thanks, Bob.
My co-host Fred Williams is Bob Enyar. Our website is realsciencefriday.com. Please check it out. God bless you. Hi, this is Bob Enyar with Real Science Friday. You can get great science materials from us, DVDs, debates, books, all from our website, kgov.com, or by calling us 1-800-8-ENYARDS. So here's a list of what you can get. DVDs from Illustra Media that we carry, The Privileged Planet, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, and Darwin's Dilemma. And then there are the two fabulous DVDs from Dr. Carl Werner on Evolution, the Grand Experiment, Living Fossils. You'll want to see those. And then Spike Passaris, formerly with the U.S. Military Space Program, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy. And then there's the BEL debates, Bob Debates an Evolutionist, Dr. Eugenie Scott on DVD, and a book, Does God Exist? Bob Enyart debates atheist Zaketh, a psychologist. We also have two DVDs on our seminar, Does God Exist? And then Mount St. Helens, The Explosive Evidence for Catastrophe. We also have our debate on the age of the Earth, where I got to debate a mathematician from CU up in Boulder and a geophysicist on this MP3 CD. And finally, my favorite science book, In the Beginning, by Dr. Walt Brown. Just call us at 800-8-ENYARDS, 800-836-9278, or check out our online store in the science department, either at kgov.com or realsciencefriday.com.